We were too hungry even to try and think of anything except food. I remember the dinner Boris finally selected for himself. It was a dozen oysters, borscht soup, the red sweet beetroot soup with cream on top, crayfishes, a young chicken en casserole, beef with stewed plums, new potatoes, a salad, suet pudding and Roquefort cheese, with a litre of Burgundy and some old brandy. Boris had international tastes in food. Later on, when we were prosperous, I occasionally saw him eat meals almost as large without difficulty. When our money came to an end, I stopped looking for work, and was another day without food. I didn't believe that the Auberge de Jean Cottard was really going to open, and I could see no other prospect, but I was too lazy to do anything but lie in bed. Then the luck changed abruptly. At night, at about 10 o'clock, I heard an eager shout from the street. I got up and went to the window. Boris was there, waving his stick and beaming. Before speaking, he dragged a bent loaf from his pocket and threw it up to me. "Mon ami, mon cher ami, we're saved. What do you think? Surely you haven't got a job. At the Hotel X, near the Place de la Concorde. 500 francs a month on food. I have been working there today. Name of Jesus Christ, how I have eaten!" After 10 or 12 hours' work, and with his game leg, his first thought had been to walk 3 kilometres to my hotel and tell me the good news. What was more, he told me to meet him in the Tuileries the next day during his afternoon interval, in case he should be able to steal some food for me. At the appointed time, I met Boris on a public bench. He undid his waistcoat and produced a large, crushed newspaper packet. In it was some minced veal, a wedge of camembert cheese, bread, and an éclair all jumbled together. "Voilà," said Boris. "That's all I could smuggle out for you. The doorkeeper is a cunning swine." It is disagreeable to eat out of a newspaper on a public seat, especially in the Tuileries, which are generally full of pretty girls, but I was too hungry to care. While I ate, Boris explained that he was working in the cafeterie of the hotel, that is, in English, the stillroom. It appeared that the cafeterie was the very lowest post in the hotel, and a dreadful come-down for a waiter, but it would do until the Auberge de Jean Cottard opened. Meanwhile, I was to meet Boris every day in the Tuileries, and he would smuggle out as much food as he dared. For 3 days, we continued this arrangement, and I lived entirely on the stolen food. Then all our troubles came to an end, for one of the plongeurs left the Hotel X, and on Boris's recommendation, I was given a job there myself. Chapter 10. The Hotel X was a vast, grandiose place with a classical façade, and at one side a little dark doorway like a rat hole, which was the service entrance. I arrived at 6:45 in the morning. A stream of men with greasy trousers were hurrying in and being checked by a doorkeeper who sat in a tiny office. I waited, and presently the chef de personnel, a sort of assistant manager, arrived and began to question me. He was an Italian with a round, pale face, haggard from overwork. He asked whether I was an experienced dishwasher, and I said that I was. He glanced at my hands and saw that I was lying, but on hearing that I was an Englishman, he changed his tone and engaged me. "We have been looking for someone to practice our English on," he said. "Our clients are all Americans, and the only English we know is..." He repeated something that little boys write on the walls in London. "You may be useful. Come downstairs." He led me down a winding staircase into a narrow passage, deep underground, and so low that I had to stoop in places. It was stiflingly hot and very dark, with only dim yellow bulbs several yards apart. There seemed to be miles of dark, labyrinthine passages, actually, I suppose, a few hundred yards in all, that reminded one queerly of the lower decks of a liner. There were the same heat and cramped space and warm reek of food, and a humming, whirring noise. It came from the kitchen furnaces, just like the whir of engines. We passed doorways, which let out sometimes a shouting of oaths, sometimes the red glare of a fire, once a shuddering draught from an ice chamber. As we went along, something struck me violently in the back. It was a 100-pound block of ice carried by a blue-aproned porter. After him came a boy with a great slab of veal on his shoulder, his cheek pressed into the damp, spongy flesh, They shoved me aside with a cry of "Sauf toi, idiot!" and rushed on. On the wall, under one of the lights, someone had written in a very neat hand, "Sooner will you find a cloudless sky in winter than a woman at the Hotel X who has her maidenhead." It seemed a queer sort of place. One of the passages branched off into a laundry, where an old, skull-faced woman gave me a blue apron and a pile of dishcloths. Then the shift of personnel took me to a tiny underground den, a cellar below a cellar, as it were, where there were a sink and some gas ovens. It was too low for me to stand quite upright, and the temperature was perhaps 110 degrees Fahrenheit. The chef du personnel explained that my job was to fetch meals for the higher hotel employees, who fed in a small dining room above, clean their room, and wash their crockery. When he had gone, a waiter, another Italian, thrust a fierce, fuzzy head into the doorway and looked down at me. "English, eh?" he said. "Well, I'm in charge here. If you work well..." He made the motion of upending a bottle and sucked noisily. "If you don't..." He gave the doorpost several vigorous kicks. "To me, twisting your neck would be no more than spitting on the floor. And if there's any trouble, they believe me, not you, so be careful." After this, I set to work rather hurriedly. Except for about an hour, I was at work from 7 in the morning till 9:15 at night. First at washing crockery, then at scrubbing the tables and floors of the employees' dining room, then at polishing glasses and knives, then at fetching meals, then at washing crockery again, then at fetching more meals and washing more crockery. It was easy work, and I got on well with it, except when I went to the kitchen to fetch meals. The kitchen was like nothing I had ever seen or imagined, a stifling, low-ceilinged inferno of a cellar, red-lit from the fires, and deafening with oaths and the clanging of pots and pans. It was so hot that all the metalwork except the stoves had to be covered with cloth. In the middle were furnaces, where 12 cooks skipped to and fro, their faces dripping sweat in spite of their white caps. Round that were counters where a mob of waiters and plongeurs clamoured with trays. Scullions, naked to the waist, were stoking the fires and scouring huge copper saucepans with sand. Everyone seemed to be in a hurry and a rage. The head cook, a fine scarlet man with big moustachios, stood in the middle, booming continuously, "Ça marche deux œufs brillés! Ça marche un chatrien aux pommes sautées!" except when he broke off to curse at a plongeur. There were three counters, and the first time I went to the kitchen I took my tray unknowingly to the wrong one. The head cook walked up to me, twisted his moustaches, and looked me up and down. Then he beckoned to the breakfast cook and pointed at me. "Do you see that? That is the type of plongeur they send us nowadays. Where do you come from, idiot? From Charenton, I suppose." "There is a large lunatic asylum at Charenton." "From England," I said. "I might have known it. Well, mon cher Monsieur Langlais, may I inform you that you are the son of a whore? And now fuck off to the other counter where you belong." I got this kind of reception every time I went to the kitchen, for I always made some mistake. I was expected to know the work and was cursed accordingly. From curiosity, I counted the number of times I was called Macaro during the day, and it was 39. At 4:30, the Italian told me that I could stop working, but that it wasn't worth going out, as we began again at 5. I went to the lavatory for a smoke. Smoking was strictly forbidden, and Boris had warned me that the lavatory was the only safe place. After that, I worked again till 9:15, when the waiter put his head into the doorway and told me to leave the rest of the crockery. To my astonishment, after calling me pig, mackerel, etc. all day, he had suddenly grown quite friendly. I realised that the curses I had met with were only a kind of probation. "That'll do, mon petit," said the waiter. "Tu n'es pas débrouillard, but you work all right. Come up and have your dinner. The hotel allows us 2 litres of wine each, and I've stolen another bottle. We'll have a fine booze." We had an excellent dinner from the leavings of the higher employees. The waiter, grown mellow, told me stories about his love affairs, and about 2 men whom he had stabbed in Italy, and about how he had dodged his military service. He was a good fellow when one got to know him. He reminded me of Benvenuto Cellini, somehow. I was tired and drenched with sweat, but I felt a new man after a day's solid food. The work didn't seem difficult, and I felt that this job would suit me. It was not certain, however, that it would continue, for I had been engaged as an extra for the day only at 25 francs. The sour-faced doorkeeper counted out the money, less 50 centimes, which he said was for insurance, a lie, I discovered afterwards. Then he stepped out into the passage, made me take off my coat, and carefully prodded me all over, searching for stolen food. After this, the chef de personnel appeared and spoke to me. Like the waiter, he had grown more genial on seeing that I was willing to work. "We will give you a permanent job if you like," he said. "The head waiter says he would enjoy calling an Englishman names. Will you sign on for a month?" Here was a job at last, and I was ready to jump at it. Then I remembered the Russian restaurant, due to open in a fortnight. It seemed hardly fair to promise working a month and then leave in the middle. I said that I had other work in prospect. Could I be engaged for a fortnight? But at that, the chef de personnel shrugged his shoulders and said that the hotel only engaged men by the month. Evidently, I had lost my chance of a job. Boris, by arrangement, was waiting for me in the arcade of the Rue de Rivoli. When I told him what had happened, he was furious. For the first time since I had known him, he forgot his manners and called me a fool.
"Idiot! Species of idiot! What's the good of my finding you a job when you go and chuck it up the next moment? How could you be such a fool as to mention the other restaurant? You'd only to promise you would work for a month."
It seemed more honest to say I might have to leave, I objected.
"Honest? Honest? Who ever heard of a plongeur being honest? Mon ami!"
Suddenly he seized my lapel and spoke very earnestly.
"Mon ami, you have worked here all day. You see what hotel work is like. Do you think a plongeur can afford a sense of honor?"
"No, perhaps not."
"Well, then, go back quickly and tell the chef de personnel you are quite ready to work for a month. Say you will throw the other job over. Then, when our restaurant opens, we have only to walk out."
"But what about my wages if I break my contract?" Boris banged his stick on the pavement and cried out at such stupidity.
"Ask to be paid by the day, then you won't lose a sou. Do you suppose they would prosecute a plongeur for breaking his contract? A plongeur is too low to be prosecuted."
I hurried back, found the chef de personnel, and told him that I would work for a month, whereat he signed me on. This was my first lesson in plongeur morality. Later I realized how foolish it had been to have any scruples, for the big hotels are quite merciless towards their employees. They engage or discharge men as the work demands, and they all sack 10% or more of their staff when the season is over. Nor have they any difficulty in replacing a man who leaves at short notice, for Paris is thronged by hotel employees out of work. Chapter 11. As it turned out, I didn't break my contract, for it was 6 weeks before the Auberge de Géant Cottard even showed signs of opening. In the meantime, I worked at the Hotel X, 4 days a week, in the cafeterie, one day helping the waiter on the fourth floor, and one day replacing the woman who washed up for the dining room. My day off, luckily, was Sunday, but sometimes another man was ill and I had to work that day as well. The hours were from 7 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, and from 5 in the evening till 9. 11 hours. But it was a 14-hour day when I washed up for the dining room. By the ordinary standards of a Paris plongeur, these are exceptionally short hours. The only hardship of life was the fearful heat and stuffiness of these labyrinthine cellars. Apart from this, the hotel, which was large and well organized, was considered a comfortable one. Our cafeterie was a murky cellar, measuring 20 feet by 7 by 8 high, and so crowded with coffee urns, bread cutters, and the like, that one could hardly move without banging against something. It was lighted by one dim electric bulb and 4 or 5 gas fires that sent out a fierce red breath. There was a thermometer there, and the temperature never fell below 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It neared 130 at some times of the day. At one end were 5 service lifts, and at the other an ice cupboard where we stored milk and butter. When you went into the ice cupboard, you dropped 100 degrees of temperature at a single step. It used to remind me of the hymn about Greenland's icy mountains and India's coral strand. 2 men worked in the cafeteria besides Boris and myself. One was Mario, a huge, excitable Italian. He was like a city policeman with operatic gestures. And the other, a hairy, uncouth animal whom we called the Magyar. I think he was a Transylvanian, or something even more remote. Except the Magyar, we were all big men, and at the rush hours we collided incessantly. The work in the cafeteria was spasmodic. We were never idle, but the real work only came in bursts of 2 hours at a time. We called each burst un coup de feu. The first coup de feu came at 8, when the guests upstairs began to wake up and demand breakfast. At 8, a sudden banging and yelling would break out all through the basement. Bells rang on all sides. Blue-aproned men rushed through the passages. Our service lifts came down with a simultaneous crash, and the waiters on all 5 floors began shouting Italian oaths down the shafts. I don't remember all our duties, but they included making tea, coffee and chocolate, fetching meals from the kitchen, wines from the cellar and fruit and so forth from the dining room, slicing bread, making toast, rolling pats of butter, measuring jam, opening milk cans, counting lumps of sugar, boiling eggs, cooking porridge, pounding ice, grinding coffee, all this for from 100 to 200 customers. The kitchen was 30 yards away, and the dining room 60 or 70 yards. Everything we sent up in the service lifts had to be covered by a voucher, and the vouchers had to be carefully filed, and there was trouble if even a lump of sugar was lost. Besides this, we had to supply the staff with bread and coffee and fetch the meals for the waiters upstairs. All in all, it was a complicated job. I calculated that one had to walk and run about 15 miles during the day, and yet the strain of the work was more mental than physical. Nothing could be easier on the face of it than this stupid scullion work, but it is astonishingly hard when one is in a hurry. One has to leap to and fro between a multitude of jobs. It's like sorting a pack of cards against the clock. You are, for example, making toast when, bang, down comes a service lift with an order for tea, rolls and 3 different kinds of jam, and simultaneously, bang, down comes another demanding scrambled eggs, coffee and grapefruit. You run to the kitchen for the eggs and to the dining room for the fruit, going like lightning so as to be back before your toast burns, and having to remember about the tea and coffee, besides 6 other orders that are still pending, and at the same time some waiter is following you and making trouble about a lost bottle of soda water, and you're arguing with him. It needs more brains than one might think. Mario said, no doubt truly, that it took a year to make a reliable cafetier. The time between 8 and 10:30 was a sort of delirium. Sometimes we were going as though we had only 5 minutes to live. Sometimes there were sudden lulls when the orders stopped and everything seemed quiet for a moment. Then we swept up the litter from the floor, threw down fresh sawdust, and swallowed gallipots of wine or coffee or water, anything, so long as it was wet. Very often we used to break off chunks of ice and suck them while we worked. The heat among the gas fires was nauseating. We swallowed quarts of drink during the day, and after a few hours even our aprons were drenched with sweat. At times we were hopelessly behind with the work, and some of the customers would have gone without their breakfast, but Mario always pulled us through. He had worked 14 years in the cafeterie, and he had the skill that never wastes a second between jobs. The Magyar was very stupid, and I was inexperienced, and Boris was inclined to shirk, partly because of his lame leg, partly because he was ashamed of working in the cafeterie after being a waiter. But Mario was wonderful. The way he would stretch his great arms right across the cafeterie to fill a coffee pot with one hand and boil an egg with the other, at the same time watching toast and shouting directions to the Magyar, and between whiles singing snatches from Rigoletto, was beyond all praise. The patron knew his value, and he was paid 1,000 francs a month, instead of 500 like the rest of us. The breakfast pandemonium stopped at 10:30. Then we scrubbed the cafeteria tables, swept the floor and polished the brasswork, and, on good mornings, went one at a time to the lavatory for a smoke. This was our slack time. Only relatively slack, however, for we had only 10 minutes for lunch, and we never got through it uninterrupted. The customers' luncheon hour, between 12 and 2, was another period of turmoil like the breakfast hour. Most of our work was fetching meals from the kitchen, which meant constant enjolade from the cooks. By this time the cooks had sweated in front of their furnaces for 4 or 5 hours, and their tempers were all warmed up. At 2 we were suddenly free men. We threw off our aprons and put on our coats, hurried out of doors, and, when we had money, dived into the nearest bistro. It was strange coming up into the street from those firelit cellars. The air seemed blindingly clear and cold, like Arctic summer. And how sweet the petrol did smell, after the stenches of sweat and food. Sometimes we met some of our cooks and waiters in the bistros, and they were friendly and stood us drinks. Indoors we were their slaves, but it is an etiquette in hotel life that between hours everyone is equal, and the enjolades do not count. At 4:45 we went back to the hotel. Till 6:30 there were no orders, and we used this time to polish silver, clean out the coffee urns, and do other odd jobs. Then the grand turmoil of the day started. The dinner hour. I wish I could be Zola for a little while, just to describe that dinner hour. The essence of the situation was that 100 or 200 people were demanding individually different meals of 5 or 6 courses, and that 50 or 60 people had to cook and serve them and clean up the mess afterwards. Anyone with experience of catering will know what that means. And at this time, when the work is doubled, the whole staff was tired out and a number of them were drunk. I could write pages about the scene without giving a true idea of it. The chargings to and fro in the narrow passages, the collisions, the yells, the struggling with crates and trays and blocks of ice, the heat, the darkness, the furious festering quarrels which there was no time to fight out, they passed description. Anyone coming into the basement for the first time would have thought himself in a den of maniacs. It was only later, when I understood the working of an hotel, that I saw order in all this chaos. At 8:30, the work stopped very suddenly. We were not free till 9, but we used to throw ourselves full length on the floor and lie there, resting our legs, too lazy even to go to the ice cupboard for a drink. Sometimes the chef du personnel would come in with bottles of beer, for the hotel stood us an extra beer when we'd had a hard day. The food we were given was no more than eatable, but the patron was not mean about drink. He allowed us 2 litres of wine a day each, knowing that if a plongeur is not given 2 litres, he will steal 3. We had the heel taps of bottles as well, so that we often drank too much. A good thing, for one seemed to work faster when partially drunk. 4 days of the week passed like this. Of the other 2 working days, one was better and one worse. After a week of this life, I felt in need of a holiday. It was Saturday night, so the people in our bistro were busy getting drunk, and with a free day ahead of me, I was ready to join them. We all went to bed drunk at 2 in the morning, meaning to sleep till noon. At 5:30, I was suddenly awakened. A night watchman sent from the hotel was standing at my bedside. He stripped the clothes back and shook me roughly. "Get up," he said. "Tu t'es bien saoulé la gueule, eh? Well, never mind that. The hotel's a man short. You've got to work today." "Why should I work?" I protested. "This is my day off." "Day off, nothing. The work's got to be done. Get up." I got up and went out, feeling as though my back were broken and my skull filled with hot cinders. I didn't think that I could possibly do a day's work. And yet, after only an hour in the basement, I found that I was perfectly well. It seemed that in the heat of those cellars, as in a Turkish bath, one could sweat out almost any quantity of drink. Plongeurs know this, and count on it. The power of swallowing quarts of wine and then sweating it out before it can do much damage is one of the compensations of their life. Chapter 12. By far my best time at the hotel was when I went to help the waiter on the 4th floor. We worked in a small pantry which communicated with the cafeteria by service lifts. It was delightfully cool after the cellars, and the work was chiefly polishing silver and glasses, which is a humane job. Valenti, the waiter, was a decent sort, and treated me almost as an equal when we were alone, though he had to speak roughly when there was anyone else present, for it doesn't do for a waiter to be friendly with plongeurs. He used sometimes to tip me 5 francs when he'd had a good day. He was a comely youth, aged 24 but looking 18, and like most waiters, he carried himself well and knew how to wear his clothes. With his black tailcoat and white tie, fresh face and sleek brown hair, he looked just like an Eton boy. Yet he had earned his living since he was 12, and worked his way up literally from the gutter, crossing the Italian frontier without a passport, and selling chestnuts from a barrow on the Northern Boulevard, and being given 50 days imprisonment in London for working without a permit, and being made love to by a rich old woman in an hotel who gave him a diamond ring and afterwards accused him of stealing it, were among his experiences. I used to enjoy talking to him at slack times when we sat smoking down the lift shaft. My bad day was when I washed up for the dining room. I had not to wash the plates, which were done in the kitchen, but only the other crockery, silver, knives and glasses. Yet even so it meant 13 hours' work, and I used between 30 and 40 dishcloths during the day. The antiquated methods used in France double the work of washing up. Plate racks are unheard of, and there are no soap flakes, only the treacly soft soap which refuses to lather in the hard Paris water. I worked in a dirty, crowded little den, a pantry and scullery combined, which gave straight on the dining room. Besides washing up, I had to fetch the waiters' food and serve them at table. Most of them were intolerably insolent, and I had to use my fists more than once to get common civility. The person who normally washed up was a woman, and they made her life a misery. It was amusing to look round the filthy little scullery and think that only a double door was between us and the dining room. There sat the customers in all their splendour, spotless tablecloths, bowls of flowers, mirrors and gilt cornices and painted cherubim, and here, just a few feet away, we, in our disgusting filth. For it really was disgusting filth. There was no time to sweep the floor till evening, and we slithered about in a compound of soapy water, lettuce leaves, torn paper and trampled food. A dozen waiters, with their coats off, showing their sweaty armpits, sat at the table mixing salads and sticking their thumbs into the cream pots. The room had a dirty, mixed smell of food and sweat. Everywhere in the cupboards, behind the piles of crockery, were squalid stores of food that the waiters had stolen. There were only 2 sinks and no washing basin, and it was nothing unusual for a waiter to wash his face in the water in which clean crockery was rinsing. But the customers saw nothing of this. There were a coconut mat and a mirror outside the dining-room door, and the waiters used to preen themselves up and go in looking the picture of cleanliness. It's an instructive sight to see a waiter going into an hotel dining-room. As he passes the door, a sudden change comes over him. The set of his shoulders alters. All the dirt and hurry and irritation have dropped off in an instant. He glides over the carpet with a solemn, priest-like air. I remember our assistant, maître d'hôtel, a fiery Italian, pausing at the dining-room door to address an apprentice who had broken a bottle of wine. Shaking his fist above his head, he yelled, luckily the door was more or less soundproof, "Tu me fais fiche! Do you call yourself a waiter, you young bastard? You a waiter? You're not fit to scrub floors in the brothel your mother came from, maquereau!" Words failing him, he turned to the door, and as he opened it, he delivered a final insult in the same manner as Squire Weston in Tom Jones. Then he entered the dining room and sailed across it, dish in hand, graceful as a swan. 10 seconds later, he was bowing reverently to a customer, and you couldn't help thinking, as you saw him bow and smile with that benign smile of the trained waiter, that the customer was put to shame by having such an aristocrat to serve him. This washing up was a thoroughly odious job. Not hard, but boring and silly beyond words. It's dreadful to think that some people spend their whole decades at such occupations. The woman whom I replaced was quite 60 years old, and she stood at the sink 13 hours a day, 6 days a week, the year round. She was, in addition, horribly bullied by the waiters. She gave out that she'd once been an actress. Actually, I imagine, a prostitute. Most prostitutes end as charwomen. It was strange to see that, in spite of her age and her life, she still wore a bright blonde wig, and darkened her eyes, and painted her face like a girl of 20. So, apparently, even a 78-hour week can leave one with some vitality. Chapter 13. On my third day at the hotel, the chef du personnel, who had generally spoken to me in quite a pleasant tone, called me up and said sharply, "Here, you, shave that moustache off at once. Nom de Dieu, who ever heard of a plongeur with a moustache?" I began to protest, but he cut me short.
A plongeur with a moustache. Nonsense. Take care I don't see you with it tomorrow.
On the way home, I asked Boris what this meant. He shrugged his shoulders.
You must do what he says, mon ami. No one in the hotel wears a moustache except the cooks. I should have thought you would have noticed it. Reason? There is no reason. It is the custom.
I saw that it was an etiquette, like not wearing a white tie with a dinner jacket, and shaved off my moustache. Afterwards, I found out the explanation of the custom, which is this. Waiters in good hotels do not wear moustaches, and to show their superiority, they decree that plongeurs shall not wear them either. And the cooks wear their moustaches to show their contempt for the waiters. This gives some idea of the elaborate caste system existing in an hotel. Our staff, amounting to about 110, had their prestige graded as accurately as that of soldiers, and a cook or waiter was as much above a plongeur as a captain above a private. Highest of all came the manager, who could sack anybody, even the cooks. We never saw the patron, and all we knew of him was that his meals had to be prepared more carefully than that of the customers. All the discipline of the hotel depended on the manager. He was a conscientious man, and always on the lookout for slackness, but we were too clever for him. A system of service bells ran through the hotel, and the whole staff used these for signalling to one another. A long ring and a short ring, followed by two more long rings, meant that the manager was coming, and when we heard it, we took care to look busy. Below the manager came the maître d'hôtel. He did not serve at table, unless to a lord or someone of that kind, but directed the other waiters and helped with the catering. His tips, and his bonus from the champagne companies, it was 2 francs for each cork he returned to them, came to 200 francs a day. He was in a position quite apart from the rest of the staff, and took his meals in a private room, with silver on the table, and 2 apprentices in clean white jackets to serve him. A little below the head waiter came the head cook, drawing about 5,000 francs a month. He dined in the kitchen, but at a separate table, and one of the apprentice cooks waited on him. Then came the chef du personnel. He drew only 1,500 francs a month, but he wore a black coat and did no manual work, and he could sack plongeurs and fine waiters. Then came the other cooks, drawing anything between 3,000 and 750 francs a month. Then the waiters, making about 70 francs a day in tips, besides a small retaining fee. Then the laundresses and sewing women. Then the apprentice waiters, who received no tips, but were paid 750 francs a month. Then the plongeur, also at 750 francs. Then the chambermaids, at 500 or 600 francs a month. And lastly, the cafetière, at 500 a month.